Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experiences of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. I don't think we finished our previous discussion about the divine feminine or the fact that it obviously had to be a woman who created the universe. I just wanted to make a follow-on from last week with this idea, because you were talking about parthenogenic.
Mm-hmm.
And Parthenon is actually the Greek word to describe the Virgin Mary. They translate Parthenon as virgin. So it takes it, I think, quite neatly back to the concept of creation being a mother goddess.
Who did? I mean, I think in every tradition that identifies a named mother goddess, there is this notion that she was alone and she was the great darkness and she created the light, her son, S-U-N-N-S-O-N, obviously, and that she then kind of married him in a way that's not as ill as it is in, you know, material human culture. And that from that union, therefore, of sacred masculine and sacred feminine, come all things. But the very first act of creation is parthenogenic. And that kind of self-generated from the feminine divine aspect of all things pagan, witchy, heathen, etc., seemed to be one of the things which Christianity as the sort of spiritual face of the patriarchy takes the greatest issue with. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that there's a huge amount of common sense as to why that might be, because the most ancient of goddesses, that original goddess, she's actually not very maidenly. She's very, very crone.
Mm.
Very crone. If you're going to reproduce parthenogenically, there's nothing innocent and flowery and gorgeous and Bridgety about you. You are the Kaliach or the Morrigan or the blooming, you know, old Mother Holla. You are the dark goddess. Mm. And she is no virgin. Although actually, I believe the true meaning of the word virgin is a woman whole unto herself.
Yes.
So she actually totally is a virgin in the true sense of the word, but not in the silly innocent sense of the word. Perhaps scratch silly from that. But anyway, I'm getting myself in a knot.
I know exactly where you're getting. I'll pick it up for a minute. Just there's a gospel called the Infancy Gospel of James, which is one of the Nag Hammadi library, I think, certainly one of the mystical ones, which tells the story of Mary, the mother of Jesus, being raised in the temple for the purpose of giving birth to Messiah.
Mm.
So she was actually weaving cloth when Gabriel the Annunciator came to her. So this is a treatise all about this parthenogenic female, this recreation of the world, if you like. And we've mentioned this before, I've mentioned this before. The first temple of Israel was much more balanced. They had two pillars outside the Holy of Holies to the goddess and to the god. And when the temple probably became corrupted, but we'll never know. When the temple was reformed, the goddess was thrown out entirely and it became patriarchy. So there seems to be some sort of pattern that the patriarchy seems to take control of something which was started by the feminine.
Can we be really clear here too, that we're talking about the contorted patriarchy?
Oh yes, not the nice blokes. Yeah, we're both married to really nice blokes.
And that to discuss masculine or the patriarchy
is
inherently broken is deeply disrespectful to the many, many, many fabulous.
Mm. It's like in Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic tree of life has a masculine and a feminine pillar, but you have to make it very, very clear that this is a masculine trait pillar and a feminine trait pillar, and they are both contained in us, and that the yin and yang can both become toxic or become flowers.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Well said, that woman.
Thank you. Anyway, back to the original point, which is that it seems to me that the reason why the current socioeconomic paradigm, the current or recent iteration of Christianity and the contorted patriarchy have such disdain for these ancient stories of parthenogenic creation is that they do speak directly to the energy that could be perceived and easily kind of metaphorically described as crone energy. So the crone is the older woman, the wise one, the one who is no longer in service to her own ends or to the ends of her direct family. So she's not maiden, she's not mother, she's in service to the greater whole, and the greater whole not just of her overtly kindred community of humans, but to the greater whole, so to all of creation. When she's really standing properly in the place of crone, she's in service to life. And that woman, she is very hard to push around. She doesn't give, excuse my language, a rat's ass for some cheeky little chappy coming along and telling her what she can or can't believe or what she can and can't do and whether or not she can attend the birth of this woman or create a ceremony for the death of that man or whatever. And that I think the kind of the throwing out of all of the presence of the feminine in the religion that has become Christianity was a power play, because women up until, God, I think we're talking right up until the enclosures, which you mentioned last time, had a lot of power. And the enclosures were a very small number of people, as ever, you know, that times version of the 1%, taking land in order to make a very small number of people rich at the expense of a very great, enormous number of people. And the disrespecting of femaleness and femininity and women generally and all women in particular was essential to the success of that. Mm-hmm. There's an absolutely fantastic book if you really want to know about how come the witch trials and how come the disrespecting of the feminine on such a massive level. Then there's a book called Caliban and the Witch by, I'm ashamed to admit that I don't remember her name, but it's, I don't think you can mistake it for another book. She's called Isabella something, and it was written as her PhD, and it's absolutely gobsmacking. The evidence in there that says that the witch trials and all the ways in which women were subdued in that time, in the 14 and 15 and even 1600s, are all about the great land grab that was the enclosures and everything that happened. And there are things like, I believe it was in Italy at that time, prostitution suddenly became legal, and the groups of young men that were roaming around in the towns because they'd been completely dispossessed from their commonly held land that they'd been previously farming in the countryside. The encouragement was, go and abuse a woman. Mm. And I believe rape also ceased to be illegal. So, you know, go take it out on some women, boys. Don't you worry. You can go and have your way. We won't mind. We won't tell you off. And that's going to keep you from turning your attention on those of us who have just taken your right livelihood, stolen your birthright of connection to land, stolen your birthright of the free food and the free houses that land offers you. Mm. And, you know, women, we carried that in our bodies, that the continuance of those rights, you know, as the ones who are the ones that make the babies, that wash the clothes and bake the bread and tend to the weaving and all that stuff. We are the very embodiment, especially the older ones, of the continuance of the generosity of the earth. And so those who wanted to take that generosity and have it all for their very own and not share it, they're what got us into the pickle we're in now. And they seem to be playing a very similar game now. These are strange times.
And have you noticed that women also perpetrate this?
Yes, but that's, that. You know, we really need to be clear over and over again that we're not talking about, when we're talking about the broken patriarchy, we are not talking about men.
No,
the broken patriarchy is alive and well in people of all genders, no matter how many there are of those. Anyone who's got a body has almost certainly got an aspect of the broken patriarchy pulling some of its strings. This is not a man-hating discussion.
No, this is not men versus women. It's masculine versus feminine.
Yeah, and even then, you know, I mean, it's very binary of us to call it masculine versus feminine. What we're really
talking
about...
more words.
Yeah, well, there are the words. We're talking about active and receptive.
Mm.
And that, yes, it's perhaps speaks to our slightly elder years that we insist on calling it masculine and feminine, because that's a metaphorically clear way to discuss these things in the old paradigm. But in a new world where they them is much more of a spoken about and allowed to be thing, I think it's way more useful to call it active and receptive.
But yes, and the temptation there is to go active and passive, and then people don't like that either. But it is the active and the receptive, because during the act of sex, in any creature that has sex, the female receives and the masculine gives. Mm-hmm. But then the female receives it and then she grows the child. So there's always a dance between those two aspects. And of course, the dance is the Trinity, which we come back to again. Mm. In Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalistic tree of life, the head of the feminine or receptive pillar is sometimes known as the Dark Mother, Bina, understanding. And she's very deep and very cold. And she is the vital match to Chokhmah, which is the first impulse of creation, the Big Bang, if you like, which is given the active masculine title to it, because without the one, the other is ridiculous. And I think it's entirely fair to say that the receptive side can lead to great cruelty, as well as the masculine. Either side that's out of balance will end up hurting.
Anything that's out of balance is off whack, as the Americans like to say. You know, I mean, that again, back to the Trinity. The in order for all to be well in the world, the one side of the Lemniska, which for me is the clearest and easiest way to speak about the Trinity, which is mysterious to some, as it looks like a two kind of sided thing. If you don't know what a Lemniska is, it's if you imagine a perfectly equal figure of eight on its side. It's the mathematical symbol for infinity, but it is also energetically a living glyph which speaks of polarity, but it speaks to the polarity of and it always, there is this third place where the either or and the and the if but meet in the middle. And so it speaks ultimately to balance, and that, you know, that's what we're supposed to be. The place of power is perceived as being in the middle, at the knot, at the place where the Möbius strip is twisted in two in the middle, so that the masculine on one side, the feminine on the other, the active on one side, the receptive on the other. When these things are in balance, then you have truth, authenticity, power, wholeness, health, all of those things. And that doesn't have to look like, I think it's easy to say that, so maybe the perfect human being or the perfect anything would be absolutely the sexless kind of...
gender fluid?
There's a word
androgynous?
For... androgynous. So the androgyn, the one who's both in the middle, is in one way the most perfect example of delicious balance. But we're humans, and although we might aspire to that delicious balance, it doesn't have to look like androgyny. Balance can be achieved many different ways, depending on where you put the pivot thing that you're standing your line on. And But when you take the conversation out of masculine and feminine and instead start talking about active and receptive, then that androgyny, that perfect, beautiful balance between my capacity to be receptive and my capacity to be active, yes, that's where we're going. That's what we're looking for.
And do you think that also it hasn't helped the fact that the receptive is associated with darkness and the active is associated with light, because people are more afraid of the dark than the light?
I think that's one of yet another way in which the ancient stories have been lost, corrupted, suppressed, etc. Because there's nothing intrinsically wrong with darkness. Yeah. You know, there are so many reasons to bless the darkness. Apart from any of the rest of them, we couldn't possibly know what light was if we didn't have the darkness. You know, all of creation exists in this beautiful lemniscatic form where you can only know a thing if there is something opposing it, if you like, in order to show it to you. We don't know what we can't intellectually or spiritually or emotionally see, and almost everything, certainly everything I can think of, we see it as much through what it is not as through what it is. And so darkness, that ancient sacred feminine, the maligning of the darkness came with the maligning of the feminine, not entirely, but a lot. Certainly the idea of the darkness being in some way evil, I believe, came with the maligning of the feminine. Although I would also say that our ancient ancestors will have had a relationship with darkness that wasn't necessarily all about sitting out round a fire, having a lovely time and singing songs. You know, the darkness does bring genuine reasons to be alarmed, potentially, especially if you don't have a fire. So we weren't necessarily always the top predator. And so there is, you know, hardwired into our fear. Brain. There's a primeval fear of the dark. Of course there is.
But if you have a fear, then the way to get over the fear is to face it and to sit in it. One of the two of the things that Susie taught me when I was ill and came to her for help, one was to go and sit under a tree in darkness, and the other was to lie in the bath at dark, in darkness, which I still do. Of course, as the nights get lighter, it's more difficult to lie in the bath in darkness, but I'd walk the dogs at night. And I did do that sitting under a tree in a friend's farm. And it was actually quite dramatically beautiful. Apart from the fact that through the fear, there is this sort of primeval fear of sitting in a dark, strange place. You don't know what else is out there. Mm. I knew there weren't wolves, and I knew there weren't lions, and I knew there weren't bears. But something primeval in me was going, you're not safe here. And I had to go, that's good.
Yes.
I don't want to be safe here. Yeah. I'm here to explore something. And safety, no. Mm. And once I'd finished, and I just intuitively knew that enough for tonight, I turned on my torch to find my way back, and there were 30 pairs of blue eyes staring at me because all the sheep in the field had been standing there patiently probably for the last half hour going, what the hell is going on here?
She brought the hay, it's a bit late. So that, I mean, again, that speaks to exactly that wonderful lemniscatic polarity, is we need to fear something. Or how can we know when we're not fear? How it's like we're back to the left hand of love is grief. Everything has its polar opposite, and we can only go as far with any of them as we're prepared to go with their opposite. So we don't really know safety until we know fear. We don't know hunger, and we don't know what it is to be full until we've been hungry. Well, you know, I'm not saying that very well, but I'm sure you know what I mean. We don't truly experience the depth of grief unless we experience the beautiful height of love. All of these things have got their active and receptive opposing ends. And then, you know, there's the many unfoldings of the many stories of active and receptive within them as well. But the basic dance of polarity with that trinity of the place where they meet in the middle is fundamental to absolutely every experience. And our experience of spirit, of truth, of existence and all the rest of it has been savagely curtailed by our culture, because we're not allowed to talk about death, and we're not allowed to talk about grief, and we're not allowed to love the darkness, and we're not allowed to honour the crone, and we're not allowed to you know, ultimately, again, apologies for the language, but to cease to give a rat's ass about this or that or the other, because our culture wants us to be a good girl, to sit down, be quiet, and do as you're asked.
It wants us to keep purchasing things.
Yes.
Which is the active side.
Yeah.
More, which
and
is
never enough.
And never enough. Never ending, never enough, which is huge bad balance. In the beginning, and whether you've ever read the book of Genesis, I don't know, the creation story.
I guess. No.
The creation story, if you're taught how to read it the way it was probably written, in the beginning, after the Elohim has created the heavens and the earth, and obviously just sat around knitting with nothing else to do until humanity turned up, because the rest of it was just so boring, please. She, male and female, created she them both, and it's still she. It's still just the Elohim. Yahweh only comes when humanity have been created. It starts off as Elohim, then it's Yahweh Elohim, and then when humanity are on earth, then Yahweh takes the lead, which tells you quite a lot. Mm-hmm. However, the Elohim, male and female, created she it both. Now, this is where the story of Lilith comes from. I don't know if you've heard the story of Lilith. It's the story that a lot of, I'm showing my age by calling them women's libbers, use as an angry tool against masculinity. But it was created for that. There's no doubt about it. Male and female created the he, them, she, them, both. Refers to Adam Kadmon, which is the primordial human being, and all creation has a primordial being that is the fount from which it comes, and the primordial human is Christ. He's called Christ. But this first being was in a world known as Atzilut, which wasn't on the physical earth. And male and female created she them both is in the spiritual world known as Berea, and it's the source being which has no gender. It's both genders. It's the both and. Mm. And then later, in the second telling of the same story, it's actually moved down a world, because the Kabbalistic teaching teaches that there are four worlds: divinity, spirit, psyche or form, when things are formed, and then manifest reality. The story moves from the spiritual world, which has no form, it's just ideas, to the one with the form in it, when the goddess says it was not good for the human to be alone. So there's one androgynous being. So from that one androgynous being, she takes a side, it's not a rib, it's a side, and creates two genders, two beings, who are meant to be in communion with each other. And that doesn't mean to say they have to be man or woman. There's just that two opposing forces mm-hmm. that work together, and that works together for gay couples just as well as it does for male and female couples. But two forces that work together in complement. And create, whether it's creating a baby or not. And that was when Eve turned up. But those who didn't understand the mysticism of the Bible assumed that Adam had had a wife who ran away on him, because male and female, she created them both. Sorry, it was my patriarchal teaching there. They come out with the he, because that's what we use in church sometimes. Because there was male and female, it must have been two separate beings, so it's a very binary understanding of it. Therefore, as there's now only one, then the girl must have run away. So they made her refuse to bow to God, refuse to bow to Adam, and go off and become the wife of the king of the demons. And this was all mooted out in the Babylonian exile after the end of the first temple. So there we start with the demonization of the feisty woman. Mm. She went to marry the king of the demons. And the word lullaby comes from Lilitu, which was one of the names she was given. And so it was a song that was sung to protect the child from Lilith's wrath against the children of Eve, because the legend is that Lilith wants to destroy the children of the second wife. And oddly enough, you can see that nowadays in the modern world. Because these
wicked stepmother.
Yes, the archetypical stories repeat and repeat and repeat until we actually get the gist of them, which we don't. So even the Bible says quite clearly it's androgynous. From this androgynous being comes masculine and feminine. Mm. And in fact, the whole story of the Garden of Eden and the tree, firstly, it was a setup. because if God is absolute, God knew perfectly well that if it set up something, that they would break the rules, because children do. And second, you have to consider that it was the female who was the first one to make an act of free will. Mm-hmm. First one to make a decision. And that's incredibly frightening, but incredibly powerful. I find it incredibly empowering. And the mystical tradition tells that the problem was not that they disobeyed. The problem was the blame.
Right.
It was landing the blame. Who told you, you know, why have you eaten from the tree? It was the woman. She gave me the apple. And that's the line. It was the woman. That's the blame that is the start of that negative darkness. And it's not meant to be there.
Interesting. No. Everything you've just said, there's a common thread within some form of paganism. You know, you talk about the tree of life. Well, there's Yggdrasil. Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about Mary parthenogenically sitting there weaving when mm-hmm. the angel comes to her. You know, there's this the notion that ancient goddesses weave the web of all matter, that, you know, mm-hmm. there's the spider creator of the web. It's, you know, when you look to the stories of almost any aspect of spirituality and listen simply to the story, there was a tree, there were a man and a woman, you know, mm-hmm. or there was a tree and someone was hung in a tree, you know, Odin hung in the tree in order to get the runes, Christ hung in a tree. The if you just kind of pick your way around the ways in which humans have tried to make sense of our relationship with the spirits, our stories are the same over and over and over again.
And contemplative Christianity teaches you to sit with the mystery and know that you will never actually understand it all. Mm. Because to understand it all takes it down to your level, and it just isn't that low. And the opposite of faith is certainty.
Oh, I like that.
But it's true.
Yeah. Mm. Wow, so, yes, I like that. Mm.
I'm going to take it down a notch and say one of the things that I'm not sure has helped women, although I took full advantage of myself in my trolloping years, was when effective contraception came into the world. Is there a case to say that women threw away a lot of their power by agreeing to have consensual non-reproductive sex?
Blimey.
That's a big question, I know.
It is a big question. Did women throw away their power by agreeing to have consensual non-reproductive sex? I doubt it, frankly.
Fair dues.
I'll be intrigued to hear your stance on this one, but is Mary Magdalene not supposed to have been a sacred whore?
No, she's not. It's actually, that was Pope Gregory. He lumped all the women together. And in fact, the woman with the alabaster jar was not Mary Magdalene. Gospel of John makes clear it was Mary of Bethany. But Pope Gregory went, there's too many Marys. It's too confusing. It's much too confusing. They're all one and they're a prostitute. And he basically lumped her in just like that. And ever since then, Mary Magdalene's been assumed to be a prostitute. And even I really should have known better, when I wrote the Book of Deborah, my first book, I made Mary Magdalene a prostitute. But there's no evidence whatsoever. But I'm digressing.
Anyway, yes. Well, no. I personally believe that I've got absolutely no facts whatsoever to back this up. But my sense is that humans are sensual beings. We are erotic by nature. We are inquisitive by nature. We like to explore. I think that there's a really good chance that we've been having plenty of sex, thank you very much, since well before Eve ate the apple, to coin a phrase. And that I think the pill may have, it might have made that more possible, maybe. Mm. certainly it meant that you could do that and not end up married.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think it probably had a massive impact on how, you know, whether or not men thought it was okay to do that, because I'm not sure at all that women were the only ones saying no to loads of sex if you didn't want babies necessarily. Mm. There are lots of responsible chaps out there who don't want to.
No, that's fair point. I'm only talking from my own experience in that I was raised by a family who did the best they could, but taught me that you had no right to say no to a man.
Ooh, dear.
That men got everything they wanted. And yet, and I know that probably, possibly, I wouldn't have been quite so much of a trollop if it, I hadn't known it was safe to do that, because I was not having sex with men out of the beauty of eroticism. I was having sex with men because they wanted me.
Right.
So I'm speaking from my own probably quite twisted and wounded perspective. But so the pill and all forms of contraception are just like everything else. There's nothing either bad or good, but thinking makes them so.
Mm.
But I am wondering whether I would perhaps have learnt to respect myself more if I had had a valid reason to say no.
Maybe, but that self-respect is predicated upon everything that's taken you to the point where you're old enough to do that anyway.
Mm.
And by the sounds of it, you're upbringing said thou shalt not respect yourself in this particular dimension, you've just got to say yes when a man wants it. So I think you had no chance whatsoever, and probably were it not for the pill would have been a mother at a very tender age by the sounds of it.
Fair point. But I want to, in the discussions, I want to bring this kind of personal stuff out, because until we talk about the wounds that we've got, we're going to project those wounds onto our beliefs about anything.
Mm, yes.
So, you know, that question was asked in genuine interest, but it was asked from a wounded perspective.
Mm.
Whereas nowadays, fortunately, I'm a crone. But actually, I had an interesting thing happen a year ago now, in that I went on a workshop where the teacher suggested that we did something that our mothers would disapprove of as part of the healing process. And in my case, it was colouring my hair. I've had beautiful silver hair for a long time, but I put henna in it. And I've still got that henna. And what was really very interesting was that even though at the time of speaking, I'm 63. By the time you hear this, I'm probably going to be 64. Even though I was a silver-haired woman before, I was off the cycle. Men weren't flirting with me. I coloured my hair. It started again.
Wow. That's hilarious.
Now, I don't know if that was something that I was projecting out, that I felt more attractive with red highlights in my hair, or more powerful or something, or whether it was a signal that I put myself back in the gene pool. I don't know the answer to that, but there was a difference in reactions to my physical appearance.
That's really funny. Oh, gosh, to be a little all-knowing fly on the wall of those particular exchanges. Who knows? We'll never know. Wow, that is funny.
Oh, I must point out here that Susie and I have two pictures up on the podcast, because we've forgotten to get a camera and we haven't got a picture of the two of us together, and we're now finding out that we're probably not going to be able to meet for a little while, so you're going to have to put up with the two pictures of us separately. But I promise you, there will be one coming at some point with the two of us either punching our eyes out or having a cuddle. And I think that's probably enough for this week.
Oh my goodness, these half an hour go so fast.
Don't they? But I'm just so grateful to be engaging in honest conversation, because you are pulling me up on things that sometimes I haven't thought of. And also, it's very interesting when you say Christianity this, Christianity that. There is an impulse to defend.
Mm, of course.
But I mustn't defend, because it's true. A lot of what you've talked about is absolutely true, and so much harm has come. But I do know that my job is to work from inside the box to do what I can to heal.
Mm. Yeah. And that's beautiful. And that's such a good and clear intention.
Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.